Okay, colleagues, welcome to this session in our series on Brexit. It's a series which is co-organised between the Departments of Government and the European Institute, and I'm sure you have been given information, but certainly on the way out you can obtain further information about the upcoming sessions. We are covering a whole range of different subjects in relation to Brexit. In the Michaelmas term, the International Relations Department had a series looking at the foreign policy implications of Brexit. This term is very much looking at the political, the social, the legal, the economic implications for the UK and indeed for the European Union. Each session is taking a different format. Some of these sessions are with a single lecturer, some are dialogues, some are panel discussions. And as you can see, today, fortunately, we have a panel discussion with three of my colleagues from the European Institute, Abby Innes, Jonathan White, and Richard Bronk. I'm delighted that they've agreed to participate in this particular session. Of course, Brexit is not something easily discussed in isolation from wider issues and wider developments, and I think today's topic exemplifies that very greatly. The role of experts in public policy debate, the degree of social and political trust, and indeed suggestions of a more populist politics is not something which is unique to the UK and Brexit. We've been observing wider developments, not least in the United States, but also in many other European countries as well. Brexit here gives a particular focus to this theme or themes. So I'm going to pass directly to my colleagues. They will organise this themselves and chair the session themselves. Thank you very much for this participation.
Thank you very much, Kevin, and I'm going to kick off talking about reasons for distrust of experts. So I want to discuss here one aspect of the populist turn witnessed in many countries since 2008, namely this growing distrust of experts and especially economists. For Michael Gove was clearly onto something when he said people have had enough of experts. I'm not going to present an ethnographic survey of the distrust felt by different groups of voters, nor a discourse analysis of the reasons given for it. Rather, I want to assess whether there is any justification for such distrust. And to do this, I'll sketch out which of the reasons often mentioned for distrusting experts are problematic and which are legitimate enough to suggest that the expert community needs to respond. In a nutshell, I'll argue that when contemporary discourse brands experts as excessively narrow in their focus, missing the big picture, or as self-serving in their recommendations, or as engaged in mere power struggles over which narrative should dominate policy, it's wide of the mark. Indeed, deliberation and collective judgments made with the help of diverse experts still represent the best way to avoid the perils of groupthink, advice biased by self-interest, or a despairing relativism that sees no empirical and rational basis for deciding between opinions. But I'll also argue that the expert community, and particularly economists, have damaged their own credibility in two important ways. First, by wrongly pretending they can forecast uncertain futures, that is, predict unknowable elements of the future. And secondly, by participating in technocratic agencies with the delegated power to make decisions, policy decisions, that stray far beyond questions of analysis to determine the very normative goals of society. And finally, I'll argue that a key role of the expert, namely helping policymakers and societies make judgments where there's no single right answer, has been made much more difficult by the fragmentation of deliberative spaces and media platforms. One common attack on experts is that they are ivory tower specialists locked into narrow ways of looking at the world, unable to see anything that their technical models and conceptual grids have no space for. You could call this a Kuhn paradigm argument. Expert scientists are locked into specific analytical frameworks that, however useful in research, entail significant blind spots and cognitive bias. So the argument might go, economists' models may be right that immigration boosts economic growth, but these same theoretical frames lead experts to ignore the social costs of immigration. Now, there's almost certainly something to this argument, but as a general reason to jettison the advice of experts, it does not fly. For one thing, those who criticize experts are often locked into a particular set of cognitive priors of their own. UKIP politicians, for example, are not renowned for their open minds about new evidence. Moreover, experts come in many forms. Some, like economists, use mathematical models and consistent parsimonious theoretical frames to tease out systematic regularities in social reality. But others, such as experts working at the Citizens Advice Bureau, have deep, tacit and practical knowledge of social problems learned from multiple interactions with ordinary citizens. And a different sort of expert entirely specializes in making complex judgments about policy questions in the light of findings from multiple perspectives. The classic senior civil servant in the UK, for example, traditionally sees her role as informing decision makers of the balance of conflicting arguments, on the one hand, on the other hand, briefing. And this break on simplistic thinking is one of the most valuable services performed by experts. Of course, when Mandarins point out difficult trade-offs and obstacles to a populist program, they tend to be derided for putting self-serving obstacles in the way of the expressed will of the people. And this brings me to another common attack on experts, that like other members of the elite, they are self-serving in their recommendations, or as traders would put it, they're talking their own book. People intuitively understand that expert advice has and is often intended to have performative effects, that is, influence outcomes. And the assumption is made that experts are therefore motivated to give advice that will lead to actions consistent with their own interests. So the argument might go, city economists only predicted that Brexit would damage the UK economy because they wanted to protect the cushy positions of their own firms in the single market. One might call this the public choice theory-inspired attack on experts. Everyone acts only with their own interest, self-interest in mind. A subtler version of this argument is that experts have vested interests in protecting their professional reputations and jobs and therefore take great pains to resist evidence that might suggest their preferred models and analytical techniques have failed. As a result, there is skepticism when experts explain away evidence apparently contrary to their advice by claiming that only their timing was wrong or that exogenous shocks are to blame. Once again, there is something to these arguments. Experts are not all paragons of public service dedicated to the unvarnished truth and impartial advice. But as much of the literature on public choice theory shows, while the theory explains many pathologies and problems, it is far from clear it explains all or most activity in the public or advice sectors. Ideology, norms, and self-interest all play their part in motivation. In particular, experts may be motivated by professional integrity or normative standards of public service. Moreover, the pot should not call the kettle black. Newspaper editors and populist politicians are not above letting their own self-interest determine lines of attack on experts or influence their ideological and policy positions. A different line of attack on experts goes something like this. They all disagree with each other. There seems to be no objective or rational way to judge which of them is right. Therefore, my view is as good as any other. This relativist and sceptical line often blends into a populist view that since argument is seemingly impervious to facts, winning the battle for hearts and minds is a matter of rhetoric, not expert knowledge. When I was trained in analytical philosophy in Oxford with its strongly empiricist tradition, it was commonplace to sniff at the French philosopher Foucault's belief that dominant narratives are an expression of power and that theory should be seen as a weapon of control, rather than an analytical tool for understanding. But Foucault's views now seem strangely prescient of the guiding philosophy of modern populism and demagoguery. Now, it's undoubtedly the case that theoretical frames and social narratives structure analysis, belief, and even behavior, and can therefore legitimately be seen as an instrument of power, and that was Foucault's point. But it emphatically does not follow that reason and expertise play no role in judging which perspective or narrative better captures key aspects of what is going on. There is no such thing as objective empirical proof of a theory, since the facts we use are partly constructed by theoretical frames we've internalized. But we can still rationally deliberate about which frame or narrative makes better sense of the brute, uninterpreted constraints we face. There is, if you like, no perfect Archimedean position from which to judge the relative merits of different worldviews, but there can be no human progress if we adopt the extreme skeptical and postmodern position that we know nothing about the world as it really is and must remain locked in a nightmare of warring perspectives anchored only in the struggle for power. In other words, there is a key role for expert judgment in settling disputes between different interpretations of social reality. Now, before I come back to this point, I want to turn briefly to two self-inflicted wounds that I believe do justify some contemporary cynicism about the current role of experts. First, experts, and particularly economists, have increasingly allowed their specialist knowledge to be expressed in the form of forecasts of the unknowable future. The future is not entirely uncertain, of course. Some aspects of social reality are predictable, thanks to systematic regularities in behavior and stable constraints. But large parts of the economy and politics are inherently indeterminate, characterized by continual innovation and novelty, and by increasing returns and threshold effects. As George Shackle put it, what does not yet exist cannot now be known. In these areas, the aim of predicting the future with deterministic models and probability forecasts based on historical data is bound to be a fool's errand. Now, not all the fault lies with economists here. Those who employ them like the illusion of control that any pretense to know the future implies. And they often want to justify their decisions and avoid blame for mistakes by delegating judgment to black box models promising to solve the equations of life. But the net effect of the continual failure of high-profile forecasts to predict the future with any precision has been a serious loss of credibility for the experts who produce them. As a result, the public understandably start to undervalue other aspects of their expertise, such as their knowledge of causal mechanisms or sensitive threshold effects. And this really matters because the inability to forecast accurately uncertain futures emphatically does not imply that experts have no clue about the future. Indeed, their analytical tools and models are still highly useful in helping us to spot emerging patterns. Experts, particularly those willing to use a variety of models, remain our best hope for learning how to navigate the unknown future. A second own goal for experts has been their widespread and lucrative employment in technocratic agencies to which extraordinary power has been delegated in recent years by politicians keen to evade responsibility for policy failure. Whether it's the EU Commission, regulatory agencies at home, central banks, or the Office for Budget Responsibility, our everyday lives are increasingly influenced by the decisions of technocratic agencies planning or regulating our future on the basis of models devised by experts. This iron cage of technocracy is undeniably an exercise in delegated power. As a result, it's hardly surprising if unpopular policies then get associated with the analytical models and worldviews of the experts involved. What appears to be disrespect for expertise may partly be hatred of the unaccountable delegated power of technocracies to impose solutions regardless of the interests of losers. But the rage may be more justifiably aimed at the experts themselves if their analytical models simply assume certain policy goals as given preferences, or if they bury decisions about key normative trade-offs in the footnoted willingness to pay or other value assumptions they use. The public is often right to be instinctively suspicious that expert policy recommendations rely in significant part on unexamined normative assumptions they do not share. Experts should be more careful to distinguish between the analytical and the normative aspects of policy judgments, as this would increase the perceived impartiality of their analysis and advice. Now, let me finish by examining some other social reasons for declining trust in the judgment of experts and in the merits of roundtable deliberation. In part, it's a tidy inclination to believe in the primacy of simple solutions, and a disinclination to accept that many problems are so multifaceted and complex that only those with considerable skill in interpreting several analytical viewpoints can hope to understand what's going on. In part, it's a healthy reduction in deference to those with superior education or in positions of power. But several other aspects of the modern media and internet age are also relevant. As Philip Tetlock and Martin Harger argue, experts are now more likely to be influential if their message is simplified to a series of sound bites or a simple binary argument. Communication skills, comms departments, and a lack of nuance, staying on message, are seen as important rhetorical advantages in the battle of ideas. But these advantages come at the cost of draining much of the nuance that expertise can bring to a debate. At the same time as the media fragments and specialist discourse makes expert pronouncements unintelligible to others, many discussions no longer take place in a shared deliberative forum in which anyone can participate. The result is a series of closed conversations in ideological and analytical bubbles, or shouting matches between narratives designed to be the perfect antithesis of each other. In modern political economies, there's less and less space for common deliberation and nuanced judgment. And this matters, since in a world of complex problems, incommensurable values, and uncertain futures, the best chance of designing good policy comes when the perspectives, knowledge, and skill of a wide array of specialist experts are drawn together, and drawn together in deliberative spaces where a collective judgment can be fashioned on how best to proceed to give effect to the paramount but frequently inconsistent preferences of voters. Thank you.
It's darker without the PowerPoint.
Isn't that the truth?
Well, hello, and thank you for coming to this fourth group therapy session on Brexit. I'm going to talk to the question of trust, or rather clearly declining trust. And to do this, I want to talk about the crisis, what I think is a systemic crisis of the state. I think we are, in fact, living through varieties of state failure, as we were in the late 1970s, and yet, unlike the late 1970s, there's no big, as it were, meta-narrative about that crisis. There's no new orthodoxy to solve it other than nationalism, which strikes me as a particularly bad alternative. So I'm going to talk about state failure and why we're not talking about it. So a crisis of democratic capitalism has actually been predicted by critical journalists and scholars for years, along the lines that governments are struggling to satisfy the social needs of the citizenry versus the changing needs of business. And this kind of argument says the failure to reconcile these increasingly polarized constituencies is going to lead to a crisis. So in academic terms, I'm thinking of people like Wolfgang Strieck, Peter Mayer, Daniel Bresnitz, John Zeisman, and so on. And while I think that that tension is absolutely real and critical and difficult to resolve, I think in the meantime, and not least in the attempt to resolve that polarization beginning in the late 1970s, something truly radical has been enacted over the last 30 years, and that is the transformation of the state itself in advanced capitalist societies. So over the last 30 years, liberal market economies in particular, like the UK and the US, have actually transformed the character of the states, their own states, via privatization, outsourcing, internal managerialism, and agentification, through the rejection of interventionist industrial policies the development of quasi-markets in welfare provision. And of course, all of these changes have happened within a context of so-called competitive tax regimes, which seek to significantly reduce the taxation of capital. Now, in those previous narratives about the imminent crisis, the state tends to be seen as a neutral arbiter. It's the thing that is neutrally trying to manage that conflict, whereas I think that arbiter itself has radically changed its character. And I also think, and what I want to argue, is that it's no coincidence that the countries that have seen the strongest rejection of mainstream liberal democratic politics are those that dramatically opened their public policy processes to business involvement, but also, and this is really important, where a newly pro-market social democratic left was most enthusiastic in joining that process and also driving that process. The problem is that very few of these state reforms have worked in the terms by which they were justified. And instead, they have aggravated rather than reduced the social polarisation that was already being pushed by deindustrialisation in the late 70s, which in turn was then increased by the liberalisation of capital movements in the 1980s. Not only that, but the unprecedented increase in the porosity of states to business involvement has massively facilitated higher levels of corruption and conflicts of interest in the states that we're talking about, albeit to varying degrees. The point is, this creates the most damaging possible scenario for democratic capitalism. In this situation, the mainstream political elites are seen to instrumentalise the powers of the state for private gain, while simultaneously withdrawing the protections of the state from the public. If we look back over the last 30 years, what we have is a story of increasingly bipartisan efforts towards the marketisation of the state in accordance with the new liberalising orthodoxies of the 1980s, typically with social democratic governments experimenting with reforms on a small scale that broke the taboo of sole or monopoly state provision, only for subsequent right-wing governments to come in and then massively expand those experiments. The dominant ideas for state reform, of course, have come from the Austrian and Chicago schools of economics and public choice theories, resulting in so-called supply-side critiques of the state. The trouble is, and this gets to Richard's point, the assumptions behind supply-side criticisms of the modern state are fundamentally flawed for at least two reasons. Firstly, supply-side reforms are based on a super-abstract, super-reductionist understanding of really existing states. Supply-siders model the state as simply equivalent to a monopoly firm or cartel with radically dispersed and hence inattentive shareholders. That's you and me, inattentive voters, right? In this approach, the monopoly or cartel is the presiding metaphor in deductive mathematical modelling of the state and its sins. But of course, if those are your working assumptions, the state is pretty much deterministically depicted as doomed to operate with all the negative tendencies of monopolies, such as exploitative price-making, rent-seeking, budgetary greed, institutional complacency, and efficiency. And of course, in that case, the only solution is absolutely to break up the state monopoly wherever possible and subject it to market forces. So the first theoretical weakness is the reductive and deterministic character of a purely economic metaphor for the state, not to mention the truly heroic assumption that a minimalised state, a night watchman state, would sustain an actual democracy. The second flaw in supply-side reading, I think, supply-side reasoning is, I think, a killer, even if you accept the diagnosis. And that is the failure in supply-side theories to anticipate what happens next if you try to marketize the existing state in practice. Because as contract and property rights theories would tell you, the higher the complexity of a good, the higher the risk of asymmetrical contracts in which the seller has higher information than the buyer, and hence more opportunities for exploiting that buyer. Transaction cost theories would then tell you that trying to manage such contracts leads to massively increased transaction costs, which can hardly be resolved because of the nature of the original asymmetric unfair contract. The vast majority of the tasks and goods provided by the post-war states, of course, violate pretty much all of the preconditions for efficient markets, such as perfect information between buyers and sellers, no externalities, and no interdependencies, which is why many of them ended up being produced by the state in the first place. So the supply-side critique anticipated nothing about what happens when reforms confront this reality, when marketisation of the state fails to produce a competitive market, as opposed to just business involvement. After 30 years of trying, the evidence is that it produces the worst of both public and private regimes, where profit-seeking firms are engaged at the taxpayers' expense, but in thoroughly non-competitive conditions. The neoliberal fantasy that pure markets could exist if only the state would just get out of the way has nevertheless persisted with, I think, predictably dire social consequences. So that brings me to Britain, which is the Brexit case, and it also is also the kind of prime example of supply-side folly. It was Margaret Thatcher's drive towards a more business-oriented approach to government that preceded similar moves in the US, Canada and New Zealand, with other states like the Netherlands and also Sweden. Sweden is no longer the social democratic paradigm that we tend to assume it is. It has undertaken radical liberalising reforms in the last 10 years. Based on the promise of better government for less money, the UK's reforms were built on the idea that not only should the economy be liberalised, but the state itself should lose its monopoly status and be opened up directly to business involvement in both policy making and service delivery. I think what's critical to understanding the political reaction of today is that this principle was increasingly accepted by the Blairite, but also the Clintonite democratic left, which saw great hopes in marketisation of the state. They hoped that you could then combine wealth creation in an era of declining growth, stagnating growth, that is, with greater efficiency and responsiveness in public service provision. They hoped that consumer choice of taxpayer-funded providers for welfare would keep the middle classes, in particular, attached to the welfare state and principles of social justice. In practice, however, the actual experiments have produced the opposite results. So according to one of the very few studies that evaluates the long-term effects of supply-side reforms in the UK, Hood and Dixon find that reported administration costs in the UK have actually risen by 40% in constant prices over the last 30 years, despite a third of civil servants being cut over the same period, while total public spending has actually doubled. Most significantly of all, they find that running costs have been driven up in the outsourced areas, so in the areas outsourced to private providers who are so meant to be so much more efficient. In the meantime, complaints and judicial challenges have soared, as have social inequalities in outcomes. So the radically reformed state has proved more expensive and largely less efficient, resulting in poorer social, economic, but also political outcomes. So in just the last 6 months in the UK, and the UK is really at the kind of leading edge of these kinds of reforms, we have seen a deepening crisis of supply. You know, this is meant to be a supply-side remedy, but we have a deepening crisis of supply in social care, in the National Health Service. We have an unprecedented recruitment crisis for doctors and teachers. The most recent YouGov poll shows that 50% of UK teachers wish to retire or leave teaching within the next 2 years. Half the teaching population of the UK. That's a serious recruitment crisis. UK trains are roughly 6 times more expensive than those on continental Europe and less reliably run. I almost didn't make it here this morning from Norfolk. And we recently saw the worst prison riots in decades at the G4S-run HMP Birmingham. UK prisons now have the highest suicide rate since records began. None of these headline figures capture the level of disruption of the central state apparatus from the internal cuts, but I can talk about that in the discussion. Despite these kinds of outcomes, supply-side reforms of the state are still promoted by the World Bank, the OECD, and the European Union, even though in weakly regulated states such as the Czech Republic, public outsourcing has enabled a level of revenue theft far higher than that from privatisation in the early 1990s. 80% of public procurement contracts in the Czech Republic are non-competitively tendered. Right? They go to one person, often in secret. I've written a whole article on that. The figures out of the Czech Republic absolutely blow your mind, and they're not untypical for the region. These reforms also threaten the basic democratic accountability of the state and the principle that a government can reverse failing or unpopular policies. The trouble is, when the authority of the state is handed over to unaccountable and poorly regulated business actors on long-term, sometimes open-ended, highly informationally asymmetric contracts, I think we enter very problematic territory indeed in terms of accountability. Trouble is, we now find ourselves in that territory, having created not just major business constituencies determined to see the perpetuation of these policies, who also, by the way, are major public major private financiers of political parties, but also businesses on whom the state is already structurally dependent in very significant areas like education and social care, for example. It is, I think, hard to imagine a system more productive of the public understanding that political elites collude with business at the expense of the public interest. The key thing to remember is that the increasing role for private businesses is also replicated throughout the state administration and its regulatory agencies, leading to a level of administrative and informational fragmentation, and hence a radical extension of principal agent problems that Matthew Flinders actually argued has ended the capacity of UK government to operate meta-governance over state authority. He's basically arguing we're in a period of ungovernability in terms of, which was the great argument of the 70s, in terms of the state knowing what is happening in its own, under its own authority, now frequently wielded in private hands. Now, Matthew Flinders in Sheffield was arguing this 8 years ago, but of course there's been a much bigger push for these kind of disintegrating reforms under the supply side, I would call it zealotry of the Conservatives, since 2010. Trying to manage Brexit is going to reveal how extremely fragmented the capacity of the British state has finally become. So, why aren't we talking about the crisis of the state as we were in the 1970s? Well, I think it's incredibly difficult for the political mainstream because they are pretty much all more or less implicated in creating the crisis. It's not the opposing arguments of the 1970s where the left could be blamed for the sort of growing pro-state reforms of, the stagnation, the Leviathan state of the 1970s. All the mainstream political parties bought into the idea of supply-side reforms. It's also now incredibly awkward to call for rebuilding state capacity after all parties have spent the last 30 years describing it as relatively inefficient compared to the private sector. So you can now take any current state crisis in the news, and the ministerial or departmental comment will typically say that the service is working better than ever and X number of pounds is about to be invested. It's exactly what Richard is talking about in terms of staying on message and saying, you know, things are going well, things are going as we intend. Labour, in the meantime, in the UK, says a great deal about how much more money ought to be spent, but very little about the structural failures that underpin the crises that we're talking about. I think over time, these responses create a level of cognitive dissonance for citizens, not unlike that of late communism, when people's experience of the state was ever more Kafkaesque, and yet the political headlines were full of sunshine today and greater happiness tomorrow. Is it any wonder that those with the poorest life chances who are most hit by these changes, because their encounters with the state are exactly with those services that are now most in crisis? Is it any wonder that this part of the electorate in particular has despaired of mainstream parties? The trouble is, it is the populists alone who have said, we see and we feel your pain. The trouble is, of course, that populists argue that the pain has been caused by the EU and liberal Democrats and foreigners, you name it, Germans, Muslims, Mexicans, gay men and women, people who ride bicycles, the Romans. What have the Romans ever done for us? The thing is, the most dangerous lies have elements of truth in them. And the truth is that we really are, I think, feeling pain, particularly the constituencies that voted for Trump in the US and for Brexit in the UK, because mainstream parties over the last 30 years have made of the state both a highly inefficient public regime and a less than half-baked market, which is now prone to all the abuses and exploitative behaviours and Byzantine attempts at regulatory catch-up that supply-siders are supposed to worry about but are remarkably quiet about when it's organised on their own watch. One of the many terrible ironies of this crisis for me is that it is the supply-siders who got us here, but it is the most extreme supply-siders who have won, if you actually look at the statements of what they're hoping to do. So if you look at Michael Gove, Ian Duncan Smith, David Davis or Boris Johnson in the UK, or at the far-right government under Donald Trump, these guys are militant supply-siders, happy to wreck the institutions of the state, but with no acknowledgement that the process cannot be brought to an efficient completion in any terms, either a public state or a privatised regime. Neither of those, neither hybrid version or the radically minimal state, will improve the social contract in any at any time soon. So I'm afraid that's my thesis. And please forgive me for being even more depressing than Wolfgang Streeck, which takes some doing.
Okay, hello, good morning. I'm going to talk under the heading of populism as the promise of agency. In the early 2000s, researching my first book, I interviewed groups of taxi drivers in various regional cities of Britain, Germany, and the Czech Republic to get a sense of their views on political Europe. What might these people, away from the centres of political and economic power, have to say about the problems of public life, the workings of institutions, and by extension, the European Union? If there was one overriding theme to emerge, it was a sense of impotence before socioeconomic forces. With an air of fatalism, though not with indifference, participants evoked a world of problems without solutions, of politicians unable or unwilling to make a difference, and of institutions that were symptoms rather than sources of address, detached from ordinary concerns. Such views were most pronounced on matters economic, and the EU stood as their emblem. As a driver called Luke in the Welsh town of Swansea recalled, combining such themes, "I picked up a guy at the station. He works for the government, and he's working on the euro at the moment. And he has said that we will definitely be in the euro, definitely be in the euro within 5 years, without a shadow of doubt. He said, if it goes to a referendum, if they say no, we will be going into the euro, everything will be fixed, we will be in the euro. He said, I'm working on it now." Such sentiments of impotence in the face of the inevitable are a widespread trope of the age, I believe. They express an experience characteristic of contemporary European citizenship, and probably of citizenship more widely. At least since the early 1990s, the real-world constraints on political authority in the neoliberal era, coupled with narratives of globalisation that insist politics must bend to the imperatives of the market, combined with each other to evoke a world of weak political agency. Governments of the period would typically emphasise the limits to what politics could achieve on the traditionally salient questions, and would call on individuals to adapt to change rather than seek to author it. Nowhere were such ideas stronger than in connection with the European Union, but they were hardly exclusive to the transnational sphere. The disavowal of political agency and its practical fragmentation across private and technocratic institutions was central to the spirit of the times. The effect, one may assume, was to weaken popular allegiance to institutions at both European and national level, as well as to mediating entities such as parties. Where decision makers are thought to have little power to improve things, there's little reason to give support or to oppose them, and every reason to disengage. "Take back control," was the message of the 2016 Brexit referendum. Against the background sentiment of powerlessness, augmented from 2008 by austerity programmes administered as necessary responses to crisis, who, in retrospect, could be surprised by the appeal of this type of message? In a world experienced as one of out-of-control forces, all the more irresistible at the transnational level, how welcome for many would be the promise to reassert control. With its focus on a series of simple, doable steps, diverting funds to the NHS, reinforcing borders, the Leave campaign cast itself as the only political group willing to take decisive action, while others stressed only what one could ill afford to do. The Brexit referendum has been widely interpreted as an expression of right-wing populism. What exactly is populism? If we leave aside polemical uses of the term, referring simply to a politics deemed irresponsible, then typically it refers to a number of features: an anti-elitist stance, a hostility to political procedures, an insistence on the category of the people, and an anti-pluralist assertion that the good of the people is incontestable. These are all important features, and all were evident in the Brexit campaign. But just as important, I suggest, is that populism entails the promise of agency. It presents itself as a politics of action, of recognising problems where they exist and of tackling them. Populists present themselves, and usually themselves personally, rather than as cogs in the machinery of state or party, as those who will act on the people's will, as those who will take control. Though this promise of agency is neither historically nor conceptually unique to populism, it becomes one of its sources of appeal in the wider context of a disavowal of agency by other leading actors of the political sphere. Those warming to such messages need not believe that those uttering them will do much to make their lives better. The substantive goals of populism may be vaguely defined, and even when clear, they may be objectionable to parts of the very constituency of support they elicit. Those for whom the fatalism runs deep may doubt whether even the agents of populism can achieve all that much, and may feel comfortable supporting them precisely for that reason. But credible to their audience or not, such invitations to take back control stand as forthright statements of intent, of vitality and a certain ambition. The point they convey is that here, finally, someone is willing to show a finger towards a world where all is said to be inevitable. There is a contrast to be made in this regard, not just with the parties of centre-left and centre-right, who have spent two decades emphasising their impotence before global forces, but also with the figures of technocracy. Technocrats, one may generalise, are no less inclined to disavow their agency. This may seem surprising. Has not the pattern of EU politics in recent years been that of such individuals stepping forward to demonstrate their capacity to take decisive measures? What of Draghi at the ECB or Monti at the head of the Italian government? Or for that matter, the guy in the back of Luke's cab working on hooking up Britain to the euro? Are they not figures of agency just as much as the populist? Only in the weak sense of actors responding to putative necessity. Whether in the guise of experts responding to the dictates of scientific reason, as central bankers generally and those of the ECB especially have tended to cast themselves, or more recently as crisis managers, bringing emergency know-how to the handling of a grave situation, the non-majoritarian agencies of the EU space generally present themselves as doing what has to be done. However powerful and discretionary they may be, such figures are most comfortable in presenting themselves as the handmaidens of necessity. They avoid at all costs the suggestion they are acting of volition, with the added burdens of accountability this would demand. For the same reason, they do little to inspire popular allegiance. It is not just that such leaders are unelected and weakly tied to anything that might pass for public opinion. They make no promise of agency. Indeed, actively disavow it. Again, populism in the animating current of the Brexit referendum is quite different. The emphasis is on an expression of will, on our deciding what is important and should be done, and on repudiating establishment notions of necessity. A rejection of discourses of the inevitable was, I suggest, a significant underlying theme in the famous statement of Leave campaigner Michael Gove, that people in this country have had enough of experts. Indeed, in the populist outlook, there is typically an impatience to get started, invoke Article 50 now, and to simplify procedures so that agency can be exercised more directly. I do not wish to suggest that the promise of agency attached to populism is necessarily a credible one. I do not want to suggest that Brexit necessarily holds real possibilities for the restoration of agency in a way that responds to popular concerns. Nor, incidentally, do I want to suggest that all support for Brexit is well described by the term populism. The promise of agency may be insincere and may pose little real threat to the economic structures that feed these concerns. Just as the technocrat may disguise the real discretion they exercise, the populist may talk the language of change while consolidating the worst aspects of the status quo. The key point is how these developments highlight the predicament the EU has found itself in. Long regarded by many of its citizens as symptomatic of a world of out-of-control forces, as one more source of powerlessness, its critique and conceivably its undoing comes in the form of an appeal to the desire for agency. There's no reason to assume this holds only of Britain. The mutations of the EU in its recent years of crisis have done little to change the state of affairs. Indeed, they may have compounded it. To be sure, the decision-making of the EU has become more visible, also more prone to critical evaluation. There is a degree of politicisation, but also ever more strenuous efforts to depoliticise it once more. In addition to the prevalence of emergency discourse that frames everything the EU does as a response to necessity, its policy regimes seem increasingly geared to system stability and automaticity of decision. Whether one looks at the economic rules designed to maintain the Eurozone, or the formulas by which refugee flows are to be managed, the apparent aim is to create unchanging rules that more or less apply themselves. Quite aside from their substantive effects, such policy regimes reaffirm the image of the EU as self-referential, as a set of mechanisms that carry on regardless. Reasons to give allegiance to such a system and to take advantage of whatever opportunities for participation it does afford are all the thinner for it. If the disavowal of political agency is one of the enduring failings of the European political space, its constructive resolution will depend on political figures other than just right-wing populists emerging to propose consequential interventions in the socio-economic sphere. A world of forces that resist positive human influence is one that leaves political institutions without a rationale.
I'm assuming it's on. Thanks very much for the presentations, which I found very stimulating indeed. Two small queries, if I may. One is to Abby and one is to Jonathan. I remember studying in the 1970s and a debate between Nikos Poulantzas and Miliband, late of this parish, as it were. And it referred to the neutrality of the states. And in what Abby was suggesting, she used a phrase, when the authority of the state is handed over to business interests. It implied somehow that there is a neutral state independent of capitalism. And that seemed to be a contrast with your conclusion, which seemed to be that you were offering no particular escape, but the assumption that somehow the state has been taken over suggests that there are modes of escape. It isn't somehow inevitable under capitalism. A query, if I may, with Jonathan, it's the reference to rules, and I wonder to what extent actually we're witnessing in economic matters with the European Union, forgive the phrase, the Germanification, as it were, of the European space. The notion that we must have rules, order, liberal rules, etc. Germany has that hegemonic power to impose a paradigm on the rest, and perhaps that is one of the essential features of what we're witnessing at the moment, the dominance of a German paradigm, a dominance of certain rules, which then inevitably contrasts with your concerns about lack of agency, as you will.
Okay, thank you. Shall we take single questions and answer them? And
shall we do... actually, that was such a comprehensive question. Let's answer that one first, and then we'll
okay.
come back.
OK, and try and be quick. Thanks, Kevin. It's a really good point. I mean, I think it's important that I emphasise, having studied communism for so long, I believe in cock-up rather than conspiracy. So I don't think there is some kind of concerted business takeover of the state. I do think it's this kind of incredibly complex process of trying to get multiple businesses involved and the business sector and consultancy and so on involved at every single level. And none of those levels are competitive. Right? Practically none of those levels are in areas either where the goods are of the nature of or the outcomes are simple enough where it would be conducive to a competitive market. So you're getting profit-seeking businesses involved in highly non-competitive ways in a very large number of areas. So rather than that, there's no big sort of meta-corporate takeover in that sense. I think it's a process of literal disintegration of provision. And loss of meta-governance over that provision, which is really problematic, which then builds constituencies which do build vested interests in perpetuating certain practices. So the second biggest contributor to the Labour Party in the last election was PricewaterhouseCoopers, which now does a lot of the accounting and longitudinal studies in things like education that the Department of Education used to do, right? So, you know, they it becomes a constituency which it then becomes very difficult to roll back, both because of the structural dependencies of the state, but also party financing. It becomes a much messier picture than it could be, right? In terms of whether the state was ever neutral, I think I tend to go with Stuart Wood's argument that capitalist states have to operate in a way that is incentive compatible with their major businesses and the prevailing production regime. But again, that's not a conspiratorial management or takeover. Within that space, there's been room for a lot of strategic management and strategic adaptation and adjustment. I think that makes me even less optimistic for the future in the knowledge economy, because the knowledge economy creates splits societies, British and US societies, between higher educated workers who can work in flexible markets where they enjoy the flexibility of very liberal markets and can afford to self-insure and like the flexibility in wages and labour relations and so on that allows for enormous mobility within knowledge economies, ICT sector in particular, versus the old mid-range technology, lower-skilled blue-collar workers who have no stake in this system at all and for whom the state is less and less developmentally helpful. So I think you end up with producer coalitions in knowledge economies that are not conducive to democratic states, to put it bluntly, in some ways, unless they are also ethically liberal.
Thank you, James.
Thanks, Kevin. Ordoliberalism. I think one of the interesting things about ordoliberalism is that it's not entirely without a notion of agency, but it locates it in the past. For the ordoliberal, it's not that there was never a decision, that there was never a popular decision, but it already happened. It's always something that one locates sometime prior to the now. That, of course, is the moment of the economic constitution. It's a foundational moment. It borrows a lot of the language of constitutionalism to treat this as something that's prior to the now and shapes the constraints within which the present must operate. So I think... And you're quite right to suggest that ordoliberalism, I think, is something which is perhaps an exacerbating factor on the kind of patterns that I'm describing, because it has this notion of an agency which has only already been wielded and within which existing political actors must now operate. Of course, there's a big discussion about the extent to which today's EU is an ordoliberal EU, the extent to which the remaking of the Eurozone is order-liberal in inspiration. I think for the argument that I'm making, one can accept that the public face of the economic regime of the EU is all about rules. I think we may want to be a bit sceptical about whether it is all about rules. There's plenty of discretion bound into this new system, discretion for the Commission to decide when to apply certain rules, likewise for the Council. So we need to be a little bit sceptical about whether it really is all about rules, but the self-presentation, the public image of this system is about rules, is about the automaticity of the rules that apply themselves. And for the argument that I'm making, that's a key point. Although we as social scientists may want to be sceptical that discretion has been eradicated, this is a system that tries to legitimise itself publicly on the idea that it has been eradicated. And that's what I find concerning insofar as that then is something which extends a larger pattern, and I think it's a pattern that is not just about order liberalism, and it's not just about the EU, but it extends a larger pattern of the disavowal of political agency.
First of all, Nick.
Well, thanks for that. Nicholas Barr, European Institute. I've been listening to you wearing my hat as an economist because it's the only hat I've got. And what I'm picking up as a unifying theme is that all of you, in parts of your talk, are talking about unrealistic assumptions, often adopted cynically by people who know they're not true. I mean, Richard, you were talking about economists making predictions about an uncertain future, failing to take account or ignoring the fact that you can make predictions in the face of risk where there is a known probability distribution of outcomes, but it's much more fraught in a situation of uncertainty. So we can price insurance for breaking a leg because we know the risk. We can't price inflation insurance because it's an uncertainty. And I think a lot of the people pushing that assumption knew it was... A lot of them didn't realise it was wrong, but some of them did. Abby, you were talking about a supply-side view of the state. The unrealistic assumption there is what economists call a first-best economy. In other words, everybody is perfectly informed, has a long time horizon, industries are competitive, etc., which is a nice model as a starting point, as a benchmark, but it's the wrong model for the world, a world which contains imperfect information, asymmetric information, unequal power, etc. And a lot of the people pushing that supply side view of the world know perfectly well that there is a huge literature on second best economics for which a whole bunch of Nobel Prizes have been awarded. But this is ignored. Jonathan, I mean, the unrealistic assumption you were talking about in part is the idea that citizens can exercise agency, which assumes, again, good information, equal power, etc. And, you know, we know that, I mean, and populist politicians adopt that assumption cynically, knowing it's wrong. Whereas we know that the correlation between income poverty and knowledge poverty is much higher than we're comfortable with. So what I see is deliberately promoted unrealistic assumptions, and my question is, what can we do to push back against those?
I might just start by answering some of those myself. I think on the unrealistic assumption about uncertainty versus risk, to take that one first, I think this is something that people do intuitively understand. So if you take the government's line during the Brexit debate about how much it was going to cost the average family if we left the EU, there was widespread derision of the figures given because people intuitively understand that you're dealing here with uncertainty. You're not dealing, as Nick said, with the incidence of fires over a whole population or something that lends itself to probabilistic forecasting.
They understood that this was a model with certain assumptions and that it was to have one figure was effectively nonsense. And the effect of this was to reduce the value of what economic expertise does have, which is to understand causal mechanisms. So when economists could have said, which they were not doing so much, explained, for example, if we leave, sterling will fall, that will inevitably mean a rise in inflation, which will hit living standards. That might have been a warning that would have been listened to, because it wasn't a point prediction. It was an explanation of a causal mechanism, and people might well have understood that. And I think by linking their expertise to these point forecasts, they really reduced their own credibility. I'm not so sure it was a cynical assumption always on the part of economists. I think the villains here are the users of economists, to let you off the hook here, Mick, in the sense that I think we live in an age of sort of logic of audit, as Michael Power calls it, of wanting to pay decision makers an enormous amount in business and in government, but they want to absolve themselves of responsibility by delegating the decision to a black box model that gives them the answer. And I think this is where I see the problem coming from. I also wanted to pick up on Jonathan's point, because I think this argument about disavowal of agency is really important, and also does help to explain much better than many other explanations why you got these different groups of voters voting Brexit. Because the losers from globalization doesn't really explain it. It explains the 30% of Labour voters who voted Brexit, only one third of Labour voters. But it doesn't very well explain the well-heeled Tory Shire vote against Brexit, where I live, where something quite different was going on. But in both cases, I think, this understanding of TINA, there is no alternative, there is this remorseless logic driving the country in directions we don't like, which in the case of the Tory Shires was, you know, all the things you can imagine, you know, gay marriage and lots of immigrants and all the rest, whereas in the Sunderland and so on, it may well have been, you know, the loss of jobs and disempowerment and so on. So different things were going on, but I think this loss of agency was the same. Where I think it comes from, and this is where I might slightly disagree with Jonathan, is I think it comes from a very anemic understanding of politics that arose during the New Labour and Clintonite age, the idea that we essentially normative debates were settled. And I think so that what you had was essentially an idea that government is in the game of delivering efficient solutions to the outcome we all know we want, which is just to have higher growth, higher economic growth for the majority. And I think the politics should be about normative debates, and that should be separated from analysis. And too often, expertise confuses these two, normative debates between which goals you're after and analysis about what happens if you follow particular goals. But I won't go on too long about that. Did either of you want to answer Nick's point?
Very. I'll try and be quicker than I was before. I think it's a really important thing. I think there are two forms of pushback. I think one is in economics as a discipline that it becomes less ghettoized, so that standard economists start talking to behavioural economists and transaction cost, you know, cost economists and theories of the firm and so on. You know, that there should be much more ecumenical discussion within economics as a discipline, which I think is a debate going on in economics right now. I think in terms of the users, the real villains in the piece, I think it speaks to the incredible importance of institutions like a neutral civil service. I think one of the reasons we went as far down the rabbit hole as we have done in the UK is the politicisation of the senior civil service, in particular with special advisors, non-executive directors. Cameron's idea that you have a PLC-type board of directors within every ministry, always from business. 30% of senior civil service appointments in the UK are now from business. And the problem is you end up with an echo chamber of voices that have an interest in a corporate version of the state, even though objectively the environment for that to be efficient doesn't exist and will never exist because of the nature of the goods we're talking about. So Michael Gove is the prime example. I think Michael Gove is a supply-side zealot. If you listen to his speeches on education, it was about freedom from, we should be free from this and free from bureaucracy, free from the blob, the institutional trade unions, teachers' trade unions and so on. We shall be free. And he called opponents of academies, which are more expensive, lower in attainment, have produced huge numbers of financial abuses over the last 20 years. Really, the list is endless. They exclude students at twice the rate of grant-maintained students. They have endless problems. He called opponents of it the enemies of promise, which is a truly Orwellian phrase. But his whole point was, I will not listen to the advice of the Department of Education because they have a pre-existing interest in the old system. Well, interest, yes. Knowledge also, experience also. You need a neutral civil service to stop people being in echo chambers, which gets to all of Richard's work on monocultures, which is also something you need to avoid.
Thanks. Yeah. One point first. I feel there's a distinction to be made between democratic agency and political agency. I've used this term political agency quite a lot, and I guess intuitively what one might feel what I'm getting at is that people feel disempowered, lack of citizen involvement and so on. I think that's a kind of subset of a larger thesis, a disavowal of political agency, which is not just that somehow the citizens feel cut out, but they start to wonder whether anyone anywhere is actually able to do anything, to have control over this. That's a slightly different thing. You might say the disavowal of political agency is kind of the larger circle. Democratic agency is a circle within that. But it seems to me not everyone who gravitates towards populism necessarily is looking for democratic empowerment. It's not necessarily that they want more citizen involvement and so on. They want to feel that someone, somewhere, can strike a blow against this bloody machine that just kind of carries on churning out outcomes. That is a question of political agency, which is slightly different, I think, from a question of democratic agency. It's not necessarily to be understood as always being the search for democratic participation. But, of course, they might go in similar directions. That maybe leads me to the second point. What can one do? I mean, populism is only one response, obviously, to this kind of scenario. This is also the age of, in some places, expanding political parties. Partisanship, as I would like to call it, is not populism. It is a response to this disavowal of political agency, but a more democratic version. That's where my distinction I just made perhaps is relevant. That's, I think, where one would look for some more positive type of response to this. In other words, populism is one way of responding. There are better ways of responding. This is an age in which one sees some of those taking shape in terms of massive expansion of certain political parties. So join a party would be what one can do, I guess.
I
also think it's a double problem because it's your lack of agency but coming at a time when median incomes have stagnated since the 1980s. So it's lack of agency at a point where the system looks more rigged against ordinary people than it has done since the war. So that's the worst possible time to have no agency.
Question here.
Hi. Yeah, thank you for the talk. I had a question
about...
I'd
like to stand up just so we can see you better.
My name is Lorenzo. I'm a student here at the European Institute. I had a question about the idea of experts. On the one hand, you have that critique of experts who supposedly live in their bubble and who are who don't live in the reality of the normal people anymore. On the other hand, in academic circles, you also have a whole range of intellectuals and academics who disagree on every single point. You have there's every ID. There is an academic who has, you know, proposed that idea is good. So my question is, how did that come about? That popular idea that the experts have like one will and one thought and one bubble, and then on the other hand, that gigantic disparity in just different opinions in the academic circle. Thanks.
I think that's an extremely good question, and I think they are two different problems. And I think As I indicated before, I think one of the lines of attack on experts is precisely that they do all disagree with each other. They all disagree with each other, so my view is as good as any other. I think you do get that quite often, and that is one attack often levelled at experts, whereas, of course, I would argue the great value of experts is that they do bring different perspectives and different knowledge to the thing, and that it's precisely having constructive debates between experts who do disagree is the most valuable use of them. But I think you're quite right that it can be seen as a problem as well as part of the solution. I think why, in fact, you do get also this incommensurable problem, if you like, of there being seen to be one expert view is a very difficult question that has a lot to do with Jonathan's loss of agency and Abby's analysis, which is that we live in a set of institutional frameworks where there has been a single view taken about how to regulate markets, and a single regulatory framework, for example, a single set of rules in the Eurozone and so on. And so you get a kind of monoculture of regulation and therefore practice and a certain monoculture of analysis. And that becomes a self-feeding bubble of views of within that area. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't other experts outside it who disagree, but those making the decisions in those particular areas may often seem to be very unified and somewhat closed-minded in their views. Does that answer your question? Any other question? Yep, I'll try.
Altrud Shakley from the European Institute. Unfortunately, I heard only half of Abby's and only the full of Jonathan, so I keep my question for Jonathan. On the one hand, I really appreciate that you try to understand this phenomenon that we now all call populism, because there's no good in us all being enraged and, you know, saying, patting each other on the shoulder and saying what a terrible thing it is. But I do feel you give quite a lot to the underlying motivation, because I see it as a much more contradictory and constructed thing against the rules and also against experts, of which no such unified actor exists. If we just think about what the Brexiteers, let's call it them, did in the beginning of the referendum, they wrote every rule that excluded every possible group that could predictably, you know, vote in favor of remaining in the EU. So the young were excluded even though you had a referendum. No supermajority was requested. It was this one question. After the decision, they have established this thing that this was the democratic vote and nobody in the parliament can represent their constituency. That vote, that agency that was there, I mean, quite a few, for example, in London, voting for remaining. That is not, the government had to be forced by a court ruling that the ordinary workings of parliament, of which the Brexiteers had always said everything is rigged against us, we want to get back democratic control. When it doesn't suit them, they are not so much for democratic control. And the last example would be even the workers in Sunderland, and I'm afraid I do not take out every voter from this willful ignorance. They are quite in favor of bribing Nissan to stay and produce, while if they would bring some Japanese factory workers, perhaps suddenly they would say we need to tighten immigration controls. That is not acceptable, and it is also upon the voters not just to engage in willful ignorance and being just me, like adolescent or even less grown-up children. That makes me angry, and I do see there is more of a contradiction and not just this understanding of people would like to engage more and be more responded to.
Thank you, Neil. Before I ask Jonathan to answer that, I would just add to that a question I wanted to ask you, which is about populism as well. Because it seems to me what differentiates populist reactions from other reactions to the goddess Tina, if you do the goddess there is no alternative, is this idea that there is such a thing as the will of the people. And once it's been expressed, it cannot or should not be countermanded. Whereas we know very well the will of the people in this case was the will of 51.9% of the people. And actually, there was no single majority for any of the alternatives. It's almost certainly the case that the biggest majority was for staying in the single market, but we don't know that because that was not asked because of the nature of binary referendums. So isn't the specific danger of populism that it has this notion of the will of the people, which can then be harnessed by those claiming to offer agency, but actually are just using this this chimera of the will of the people for their own ends?
Thanks both. To Valtrout first. I'm not trying to rationalise Brexiteers, but the appeal that they might have beyond themselves. Of course, it's highly strategic what went on in the Leave campaign. It's highly insincere, I would say, in its use of arguments, not least arguments from democracy and empowerment and so on. I don't believe any of those. And it's not my intention to make an argument for why we should understand the success of the Brexit campaign as it being somehow an expression of democratic agency. I don't think it was that, but I think its appeal was precisely because it was making that kind of argument, however insincerely, in a context where far fewer were making that argument. The Remain campaign much more often tended to highlight risks, dangers, the impossibility of doing certain things. And in that context, the field is left open for those that say, volition, we say this, we want this. I don't buy it, but I think this is part of their appeal. Richard, and which part of populism is the problematic part? I don't actually think it's the idea of the will of the people. I think it's a certain idea of the idea of the will of the people.
Tyranny of the majority.
It's a kind of holistic idea. It's the idea that the 52% and 100% are the same. It's the idea...
The nation.
I agree. That's exactly what I mean. I agree with that.
That is what populism is about. The idea that the will of the people is important, I think, as a democratic idea, and that idea can also be interpreted in different ways from the populist one. It can hold out space for reasonable disagreement. It can hold out ideas of the legitimacy of opposition as well as the legitimacy of disagreement. But those are not what populism is about. Populism is about interpreting the will of the people as though it meant some idea of the holistic people which is naturally undivided and for whom the only empirical source of division is going to be some kind of unnatural intrusion upon its holistic will, whether that's outsiders, whether that's internal enemies or so on. But the natural order is that the people agree. That is the populist interpretation of what the will of the people means. So I would slightly disagree. I don't think the problem with populism is that it believes in the importance of the will of the people as a foundational idea. I also believe in that. But what they mean by that, I think, is a problematic thing.
I mean, it's also classically that the people are pure and the elite is corrupt as well, isn't it? So it's that the corrupt elite have betrayed the pure people, which kind of feeds into what I was talking about, I think.
And I think it's the tyranny of the majority. I mean, the essence of democracy as opposed to populism is that the will of the majority should have effect, but it shouldn't be without any consideration of the needs of the minority, and particularly if the minority is extremely large. And it seems to me one of the most dangerous aspects of the debate post-Brexit is essentially the idea that those in the 40%, 8% owe it to the rest of us just to shut up now and have no say on the nature of the solution.
But that's why they're being called elites, because the idea that those who are against Brexit are part of the corrupt elite.
But those under 25 who voted 4-1 in favour are not elites.
No. But you know, if you look at the kind of grotesque abuse of Gina Miller, for example, you know, the arguments are exactly that these people who oppose it are the elites, and they are part of the problem that got us here in the first place, and versus us the pure masses. So they're claiming to be, we are the amis du peuple, you know, we are the friends of the people. Obviously, you wouldn't say in French in Britain, but.
I'm just going to ask each of us to sum up for 1 minute. And of course, now the questions will come. Okay, quickly.
Thank you. I feel like the European Institute of Student. I feel like the term populism is used highly inflational. In the last couple of months and the past year and so on. And what I like about Jonathan's idea about the promise of agency is actually that it widens possibilities to address certain political movements as populists. But now in our discussion, I think we've come back to a more narrow idea that, for example, Jan Werner Müller, I think, supports as well, of populists essentially being anti-pluralist. And so basically anti-democratic, which you can certainly see in most right-wing populist movements that we see today, is it in Germany or Brexit and Trump. But does this allow us to talk about, for example, Southern European populism as what we see with Syriza in Greece or Podemos in Spain? Does it allow us to call that populism as well, or is that then not populism anymore because it's essentially not anti-pluralist in that sense? So there's a difference, I guess.
Okay, anyone?
Thank you for being here. This is Francesco for the European Institute. My point is the following. I don't really understand the argument or advanced by some Remainers according to which, this is clear, this UK Parliament should be involved in the process of the Brexit talks. It should somehow slow down or arrest the process of Brexit. If we give for granted that the majority of the British citizens who voted for leaving the European Union has no qualifications, it does not belong to the elites of the UK, is it unrealistic or even more populistic to affirm that the British people now should be asked how the withdrawal from the European Union should happen? I don't know if I made my point clear. There is no alternative now to this management of the Brexit in this way, okay? This parliament has no legitimacy. Even if it wanted to, it couldn't slow down nor stop Brexit because it would violate the will of the British people, which we can dislike. This is the will of the British people now. So, I don't know, isn't it populistic, the idea itself of now asking British people, what should we do now? Like, if they have been able to vote for Leave, they have been like this dramatic in their choice, like, now there is no alternative, no? The path is already signed. We are going to the Brexit. There is no alternative. British people should just accept it. We can only use within sight these ideas, these perspectives, to avoid this mistake to be committed again in future. Thank you.
Thank you. I think there's almost no disagreement that given the vote, we have to leave. I think there are a few people who would like to turn the clock back, but there are very few who don't accept the decision. The key is to how you arrive at a solution as to how we leave. And there are two different possibilities. Well, there are three different possibilities. One is it's decided enclosed behind closed doors by one person, effectively, who's never been elected to be Prime Minister, namely Theresa May. She's obviously been chosen as leader, and a few of her close colleagues. Or should it be decided by representatives in Parliament, or should it be decided by another referendum, which is incidentally the Liberal Democrat Party's suggestion? Those are three possibilities. So you either give it back to the people to decide which of various alternatives, or you decide in Parliament, or the executive decides and railroads it through, which is what looked as though it was going to happen.
Again, the second solution, to ask this Parliament to intervene. No, because this Parliament has no legitimacy.
What do you mean it has no legitimacy? It's been elected.
Did you elect this Parliament to withdraw the UK from the EU? No.
No, but we elected them as representatives.
But these are representatives. candidates which may be able now to change their minds. They weren't elected for the purpose of withdrawing the UK from the EU. So for me, 10 people in the UK government or 300, 400 in Westminster, none of them should actually address this topic using their own. So I don't know if I made myself clear. This parliament wasn't elected with the purpose of Brexit.
So the 48%
No, no, there should be other, a general election now.
This
is the only way this parliament would be actually legitimate.
Just to draw...
Otherwise, it's just like violating the norms in any case.
But just to draw this to a close, I think where I would agree with you is that there is an inherent clash whenever you get popular votes clashing with representative democracy. And that is an issue here, which is that we generally are governed by a representative democracy where we elect representatives to make decisions on our behalf. In this case, a decision has been taken directly by the people, and it's difficult to align that with a representative democracy where most of the representatives think this was a mistake. Can I just come back with one point which I've been wanting to say about Abby's thesis? Because I think what I love about her thesis is that it's turning onto the analysis of the state and its failures the lens of standard economics. So it's saying the problem with the way the state works is that it's created false markets which aren't real markets, and where you get information asymmetries or hold-up problems, externalities, and so on. So it's almost a classic kind of economic analysis of the failure of the state. And I think there's another little example of this that we could give, which is Hayek's famous argument about why command economies can't work, which is that the state can never know enough without the use of the price mechanism through aggregate data and so on. And five-year plans, these things never worked. And he was quite right. That is why Soviet command economies and so on collapsed, is that the center can't do this. But what we've seen increasingly in the modern state and in modern corporations, incidentally, is the reemergence of five-year plans, of the use of aggregate data, of trying to control from the center a wide technocracies, sort of distributed technocracies, and it can't work. So I think there may be more ability to turn the sort of, I could say, standard, even Chicago economics lens back onto the failures of the state, which might help.
Yeah, no, it's indicative planning all over again. Yeah. Jonathan, do you want to speak to the point about...
Yeah, just a footnote on that. Of course, it's an interesting question why liberal economics within evolved away from the Hayekian critique towards something neoliberal, which has a very different attitude on that particular point. Just on the question of populism, I agree it's... It's an overused term increasingly. I don't know whether we need to use a term to describe things like Syriza, Podemos. They may sometimes speak in certain ways that have continuities with populism in terms of references to the people. But I don't think necessarily, coming back to the point I made before, these are necessarily movements. There are many things going on within Syriza, many things going on within Podemos, but I don't necessarily think the leading voices are those referring to one true people, an idea of the holism of the people, to the impossibility of reasonable disagreement. I don't think that's necessarily how we need to read them. I would rather use terms like partisanship, which again have some continuities, some type of commitment to agency, to ideas, to ends, as opposed to technical necessity and so on, but also have important differences, hold open the contestability of their claims, as opposed to treating them as self-evident, commonsensical, and so on. So I think there is a useful meaning of populism. I think Jan Venemuller, that you mentioned, has written a very nice book on exactly that. And I don't think we should use it more widely than we need to.
Abby, do you want to say one last
thing? No, I think we should let people go in case
Great.
They have to go.
Thank you very much to everyone for coming.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.